Okay. I'd like to start by saying something about what I call the experience of language. Typologically, this language... Oops, let's turn that off.
Heard of Eskimos drum songs, or behek, are a traditional pre-Christian form of entertainment.
I'd like to start by saying something about what I call the experience of language. Typologically, this language is, first of all, it's an Eskimo Aleut language, obviously, and is thus related to some degree to all the Inuit dialects spoken in the circumpolar region, but belongs, of course, to a language family which is quite distinct from any European language. The Inukhwe are able to understand parts of certain Canadian and Alaskan Inuit dialects, but seldom enough to hold a fluent conversation. Polo-Eskimo is a polysynthetic, it's an agglutinative language, which means that sentences are formed by gluing lots of different affixes to stems to create long words. There are over 400 affixes to learn, and every verb can potentially decline up to 700 different ways, given the very rich tense and mood system. With a system of agglutinative affixes, it is possible for words to be at least 50 letters long. And I just take this example here from one of my informants, a storyteller who was talking about walrus hunting when he produced this rather marvellous sentence, and I'll give you a translation below there. This penultimate word, which I think is 49 letters long, can be roughly parsed as follows. So, amit dahi means many, ungu comes from the verb to be, kupashua means greatly, kadda is an affix, which is a grammatical participant telling you that somebody is involved. The letter u comes from the verb to be, kadda is an affix meaning repeatedly, if something is done repeatedly. Rama, from the verb to have in the perfective tense. Ungitchu is your negator. Ru, your intensifier. And finally, gama, a first person singular in the causative tense, which is not a tense that we have in English. So that would mean roughly something like, have not taken part in many hunts involving many people. So it just gives you an idea of how complex grammatically this language is and how alien it is for anyone coming from a European background, at least. Polo-Eskimo is a language of glottal stops, and outsiders have often described it as not sounding like a language at all, but as a series of sighs, heavy breathing and broken, jerky sounds. Melo Ponti, the phenomenologist, said that language is gesture, and working in a context without a standardized written tradition, I certainly came to recognize and appreciate the gestural or existential significance of speech. As I came to uncover the meaningful gaps and threads of silence, it also became apparent to me that the language of the Arctic hunters expresses as much by what is between the words as what is in the words themselves. Impressionistically, one might say that Polo-Eskimo is a language that comes from the stomach or the middle part of the body. The word for yes, is a creaky expulsion of air from the stomach and nothing more. When I started to learn the language, I was told that in order to master it, I would have to learn to make the sounds of a polar bear. So this is a metaphorically weak language with almost no proverbs, and it is a community where ways of learning and knowledge are experiential. It is true that sociocultural experience is constructed, transmitted, and performed through the filter of storytelling, but a more significant medium of instruction and relaying knowledge, today at least, is through actions themselves. Elderly people told me time and time again, in sort of plain matter-of-fact fashion, in the olden days there was not much need for language. And by this I think they meant that language was used very directionally. I'm going out hunting, I'm doing this, I'm doing that. But there was little debate or discussion about anything, and I think that remains the case to some extent today. Today, many linguists wish to reduce language to a fixed synchronic cognitive code, pitted in a universe where man is absent. But a year in an Inuit community reinforced my belief that utterances are artifacts in social space that derive their meaning from their place in diachronic processes of human interaction and cultural production. Working in the context of a language with no strict written tradition, one really cannot help but focus on the user of language, the speaking subject, moving away from the notion of language as something static and objective to focusing on the experience of the spoken word. And in a corner of the Arctic where the words share the rhythm and lilt of the local soundscape, language seems to lie at the deep structure of the sensory landscape and to be much more, in fact, than a disembodied, purely formal set of grammatical and syntactic relations. With a host of almost indistinguishable palatal fricatives sounding like the wind blowing across the ice sheet, one cannot help but focus on the what you might call the inner content of language. Linguistics is not concerned with the totality of human experience, but a phenomenology of speech would surely try to determine the place of speech with regard to this totality of human experience. So for me, the voice of the Arctic hunter was really something transcendental, reverberating in my head long before I could formulate a correct or grammatical sentence. And in a place where the soundscape intermingles with human voices, it seemed to me that music actually precedes grammar. In such an environment, one becomes, I think, sympathetic to the idea that words imply verbal experience in which the word carries a meaning that conveys a thought as a style, an emotional value, perhaps an existential mimicry, rather than just a conceptual statement. To know the meaning of a word is not just a question of acquiring an appropriate phonetic motivation. It involves a familiarity with an entire universe of meaning where language and society interpenetrate the lived value of words. For my language documentation work, and I've collected about 200 pages of words, expressions, and grammar on this language, it was obvious to me that the Inukhwe do not in fact conceptualize language in the same way that we do. In a context of affixation, where a basic stem is qualified semantically and grammatically in very complex ways, the value and meaning of lexemes, or words in a dictionary sense, is really very limited, and for some, I think, completely meaningless. Breaking language up into stems and affixes and conveniently parceling everything into little semantic boxes was absolutely not their experience of language. Our experience of language leads us, however, to objectify the world around us, writing and speaking of every entity as though it were a determinate, quantifiable object without its own sensations and desires. As though, in order to describe another being with any precision, we first had to strip it of its living otherness, or had to envision it with a set of passive mechanisms with no spontaneity, no subjectivity, no active agency of its own. Through language, we arguably isolate human awareness apart from the sensuous world. And I was reminded that this was not the right approach to learn their language, but of course that was the only way that I knew. Now, with the absence of a written culture, Polo Eskimo has historically been the vehicle for a rich tradition of storytelling. Historically, there were two different kinds of stories. There were the Okaluktua, which were the old tales, the legends and myths, and there were Unikga, which were more factual accounts. Today, the former have all been forgotten, but many of the legends and myths were recorded by Knud Rasmussen and Erik Holtvedt in the first half of the 20th century. All the stories that I recorded fall into the latter category of so-called Unikga. Among the Inukhwe, Amalalik Kavya is often considered the best storyteller of the 20th century. She was Erik Holtvedt's lead informant. Erik, a Danish anthropologist, worked in the region in 1937. Amalalik had learnt her stories from her grandmother, Ituksasawak. Ituksasawak was one of those that came in the last wave of emigration from Baffin Island in the 1860s. So here we have a map. So I spent a year in these, primarily in these three places here, mainly in Kaanak, but also in the settlements of Siliopoluk and Sivisivik as well. This is Ellesmere Island here, this is Baffin Island here. And most of the Inukhwe came in various ways of migration over the top when the sea ice was frozen from Canada, which largely explains why their dialect is so distinctive from the other dialects in Greenland, because essentially they are speaking a dialect of Canadian Inuksuk in Greenland. So by tracing, in fact, the families of these last storytellers, it is clear that there must have been, I think, a very strong tradition of storytelling in that part of the Canadian Arctic, in the Baffin Island region. And that this last wave of immigration from Baffin Island enriched the Polo Eskimo culture considerably. I think we can be fairly sure of that, because we know that the Polo Eskimos, or the Inukhoe, actually forgot how to use a kayak. And it wasn't until this new wave of migration that they once again were taught how to use a kayak from these people. From the 1970s onwards, roughly, it seems that the tradition of grandmothers telling their grandchildren the old tales and myths broke down quite suddenly, and then the old stories, lullabies and creation myths more or less disappeared in a generation. The whole traditional culture of storytelling is now vanishing as globalization, modernity and rapid socioeconomic change really exposed the community to very complex pressures. Over the last three decades, the storytelling transmission process has begun to break down for the first time, and the spoken forms and traditions by which place-specific knowledge had once been preserved and disseminated are rapidly becoming no longer operative. The introduction of television in the 1980s, Carnarvon, the town where I spent much of my time, got television in 1984. So the introduction of television and more recent digital entertainment has certainly, I think, to some extent eroded this ancient cultural practice. Siliop Luk in the far north here, the most northern permanently inhabited settlement in the world, with a population of 59 people, only got television in 1990 when the tiny power plant was built. According to one hunter, this changed everything. Stories were still told, but increasingly only whilst out on hunting trips. The stories are testaments of perhaps the last Polo Eskimo hunters. They were always, it's important to emphasise, they're always a social activity. They're never a rarefied product. Nowadays, the stories still told are primarily life stories, sometimes life stories presented as travel narratives. Typically, the men tell hunting stories, whilst the women speak about domestic life at home. They are both, in my opinion, extraordinary records of survival. The men's hunting stories are significantly stories about animals that are hunted on the sea ice, or hiku, and not fishing or land mammals. The practice and drama of hunting polar bears in particular is, for obvious reasons, conducive to storytelling. Polar bears hunt on the sea ice, and in a world where there's no Arctic sea ice, and I predict that will be in about 25 years' time, it's difficult to see how either polar bears or the stories can survive. The stories are not great works of literature, but in my opinion they're much more a way of speaking that take you back to the rootedness of human language. They show you how extended family connections are foundational to life in the region. The stories are records of prodigious memories and social history. With extreme precision, storytellers talk about events that happened 70 or 80 years ago. One gentleman told me that he could remember the day he was born. In the absence of a written tradition, all knowledge is stored orally. And one friend and informant, featured here on the slide, Idbi, sitting in my hut in Carnarvon with my books, told me shortly before I left the exact day and time that he first met me down by the shore 11 months earlier. The telling of stories takes you to places. It takes you to old hunting grounds. It takes you to now abandoned settlements. 50 years ago, the Inukhoe were living in 14 different settlements. Today, they live in four. The stories take you, perhaps first and foremost, to the icy wilderness. For narrated events always happen somewhere, and for an oral culture, that location is never merely incidental to those occurrences. The events belong, as it were, to the place, and to tell the story of these events is to let the place itself speak through the telling, if you like. The landscape for the Arctic hunters is mnemonic. It's a trigger for the telling and preservation of the stories, and memory is really a way of, I think, articulating the relationship between community and landscape. From the stories, we can infer that for the Inukhoe, land and kinship, principally, are perhaps the most important attachment points for memory. Stories tie families together and reaffirm kin relations and genealogies, And in a society like this, kinship is your safety net. The storytellers I worked with spoke of the land and the sea ice as boundless. The sea ice, I think, for them symbolised travel and mobility. It's the highway that connected all of the Inukhoi settlements. Hunters used to hunt bears and musk oxen on Ellesmere Island. This is this island right at the top of Canada, just over the narrow strait from Greenland. And one of my informants spoke of the horror and disbelief when he encountered for the first time the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, who prevented him from travelling across the Smith Sound to the land of his ancestors. The concept of formal boundaries seemed incomprehensible to him. This sense of mobility has changed radically, I think, in the last 30 years or so, primarily because many of the smaller settlements have closed down, people have moved to the town, and the area of the sea ice has diminished considerably. Here on the left is Kunudengawak Yarimiasen. He is the oldest member of the community. He's 88 years old, which is very old in a place like this, because life expectancy is about 60, 65. He's a former hunter. He started his story, which took several days to record, by describing in great detail how he spent his third birthday. Hopefully we can just hear a bit of that now. Obviously, I won't play all of that because it goes on for days. But he goes on to tell the story of how he killed his first seal when he was just 5 years old, which was a very significant event for a boy growing up in such a hunting community. And the cultural expression of respect for animals is manifest in what you might call first catch celebrations. So when a boy catches his first seal, friends and family are invited to his parents' house for coffee and cake. The first catch celebration is a recognition of the boy's development. It's almost as a rite of passage, if you like. When he was 10, when Kuludengawak was 10, he got the message that his mother had died in another settlement 2 years previously. 2 weeks previously, I should say. He got the message from a hunter who visited Siriopoluk to tell him the news. And at that time, in the 1930s, travel by dog sledge was the only means of communicating such news. Kuludengawak was subsequently brought up by his uncle and aunt, who had lost a child of their own. This is a fairly common arrangement in Inukhoi society, where the upbringing of a child is a collective responsibility for the members of the extended family. One of my friends, in fact, gave his newly born child to his uncle because he already had two children and his uncle wasn't able to have any. Kuludengawak, it seems from his story, enjoyed living with his aunt and uncle, and talks of how his aunt showed him how to make a tent out of seal skins. At the age of 12, Kuludengawak got his first dog team whilst living in Savisovic. This is not Kuludengawak, I should point out, this is my friend Elengawak, whilst out at war was hunting. Kuludengawak also talks about how he made cuts out of the skins of little orcs that he caught in the summer of 1931 in Siriopoluk. In the second week of May every year, about 5 million little orcs turn up at this one settlement, almost on the same day every year. What comes out in his story, really, is the complete freedom that he had as a child. Also, Kuludengawak told me in his story how on a long polar bear hunting trip, his brother fell seriously ill. He had got trichinosis from eating polar bear that had not been properly cooked. If you eat polar bear, it should be boiled for at least 24 hours. His brother's condition deteriorated, and they were too far from a settlement to get any help. During the night, his brother died, and Kuludengawak could do nothing to save him. Kuludengawak sat next to the body and prayed throughout the night. In the morning, his brother came back to life. He also talks about how he travelled from Seljopolok to Sevisovic by dog sledge in the spring to marry his wife. On the way back, the newlyweds fell through the thin ice, but managed to clamber back onto the ice by pushing themselves up onto their backs. That way you have a much better chance of getting out. If you climb out head first, you're likely to break off more of the ice with your hands as you climb up and put pressure on it. So this is one example of how really crucial practical knowledge tends to be passed down in the form of a story. Once out of the icy water, he and his wife spread their weight across the thin ice as a polar bear does and pushed their way onto the thicker ice. Kolodenwak told me repeatedly that he had met his wife many times in his dreams some years previously. And knew exactly who she was when he met her in real life for the first time. Dreams play a very significant role in polar Eskimo life, and the people listening to this story did not seem remotely surprised by this confession. He also told the story of how the day that he discovered a dead Kvitdok in the wilderness. Kvitdok is a mysterious supernatural wanderer who has been perhaps shamed or rejected by the community and leaves the settlement for the wilderness. Unable to live any longer in society. And of course, it's not possible to survive in the wilderness for very long. There's nothing to eat on the ice sheet. And so they end up dying. And Kulodenwak tells the story of how he discovered this body in this cave. As one small example of the kind of knowledge which traditionally has been passed down in the form of storytelling, let me just tell you about the winds. So during the recording of Kulodenwak's life story, he spoke of 18 different types of wind. Here are some of them. So starting at the top, we have the Abannak, which is a wind from the north or northeast, which is generally quite strong. It comes from Irdar, which is a settlement north of Seljopolok, which is now closed down. It used to refer to a strong northerly wind that brought a lot of snow with it, but now it is just a strong northerly wind, and in fact, in this part of Greenland, they don't get anywhere near as much snow as they used to. It makes big waves on the water, unlike the next one down, the Pabangainak, which is a wind directly from the north that makes the water flat. The Anlachia is the wind that blows the icebergs and incipient sea ice away. The Kuhohanetdok is a mild wind that blows alongside or down a river. The Kannannak is a wind that blows in from the sea and brings fog or mist. This wind tends to be the harbinger of summer. The fog that this wind brings is the best indicator that summer will soon arrive. The Bigannak is the wind that blows down from the mountains and blows this mist or fog away. The Nigek is the wind that you saw in the film there whilst I was living in Sevisovic. It hits the settlements in February and March. Whilst I was living there, it was sort of three or four times a week, actually. This is a wind that comes from the east or southeast. It brings snow with it and it brings very low pressure. Nowadays, the hunters hope for this kind of wind because it brings snow. Sometimes they have a problem taking the dogs out on the sea ice if there's no snow on top of it because it hurts their paws, so they're grateful for the Nigek. The Bishuahok is, I think, one of the most dangerous winds. It's a dangerous kind of wind because it brings fog or mist. It really brings conditions sort of which reduce visibility to zero. And if you know this kind of wind or storm is on its way, then you really have to flee from the sea ice and get inland as soon as possible. Obviously, it's very dangerous if you get stuck in a whiteout whilst on the sea ice. And finally, here at least, the Aduanak is a wind that blows down the narrow strait. This is the strait that lies between Greenland and Canada at the top. The wind is very strong. It brings very big waves with it, damaging the edge of the sea ice and making it difficult to hunt walrus. The wind also brings snow with it. I was living in Seljopolok in April and May, and they identified this wind by looking at the top of Cape Alexander, where a cold, moist air hits the top of the mountain and makes a small cloud called a kalalik. I could go on and on and on, but the important point here is that this kind of knowledge is not being passed on, and yet it's actually essential to know if you want to hunt. This is Paulina Christiansen. Paulina is the great-granddaughter of the American explorer Robert Peary, who has many descendants in the community, and she became a good friend of mine. From Paulina's stories, one really gains a sense of the extraordinary resourcefulness of the Inuhui and how nature was used simply to survive. Paulina tells how they used to make underwear out of the feathers of the little auks, these little birds that I told you about, how she would have to maintain the blubber lamp as a child, and how tea was made out of the small flowers that she would collect during the summer. She also tells stories which really show, I think, how the state of the sea ice, the movement of animals, and eating patterns have all changed very radically in recent years. So there used to be, for example, Arctic hare, caribou, ptarmigan, and Arctic fox hunting, all on the slopes behind Karnak, but not anymore. As a wife to a hunter, most of her time was certainly spent cooking, sewing, repairing clothes, chewing the sealskin of her husband's gemidga, these sealskin boots that hunters wear during the winter, choose them to make them soft. There's a very strong sense of community in her stories. All food was shared. Food now tends to be shared amongst families, but not necessarily community-wide, except in the more outer settlements. There was also a very clear sense of nomadism. The polar Eskimos were itinerant up until about the 1950s, moving from one settlement to another as they followed the animals and birds. Hunting prospects determined movement, diet, social life, and even games. And of course, she also tells the story of how a US B-52 bomber with four nuclear bombs on board crash-landed into the sea, not far from the US airbase at Paduffik, which lies south of Karnak. It was during the dark period in 1968, and she could see a huge ball of fire 100 miles away. One of the bombs still lies at the bottom of the sea today, but the B-52 crash is a whole different story. Here he is again. This is Ayako Michik. I became good friends with Ayako and his wife, Anna Michik. Took many months to get to know him and to get him to tell stories to me. He told the most extraordinary travel stories, actually, about polar bear and walrus hunts in particular, and the story of the day when he realised he could not become a shaman. In one story, Ayako talks about his journey with a group of Europeans to the so-called Kalahariak, and this was in the 1970s. Kalahariak literally means the big navel, but it's the word used for the North Pole. It comes from the word kala, meaning bubble or concentric rings. The word, I think, was only coined after seeing white men pore over the maps of the Arctic region. The concentric rings refer, presumably, to the lines of latitude around the pole. Ayako was born in the 1940s, 1943, in fact, in a place called Neki, which is an abandoned settlement way up in the north of Greenland, which was closed down in the 1960s. He told me that his parents had hoped very much that he would become the next shaman in the settlement. And one of his stories goes like this. He was out hunting and he was on his own, and he came across two Arctic hares. They were singing and they were talking to each other. He ran back to the settlement and told everybody, and from that point on he realised that he could not be a shaman because he wasn't able to keep a secret. The supernatural often crops up in conversations, and ghost stories are very common. In fact, they're often played on the national radio. And as I came to discover time and time again, the inner Hui are hypersensitive. They can see things that we cannot. But surely it's first and foremost its wisdom that is passed on through these stories. Ayako once told me a story of how a young hunter became ill after eating the liver of a bearded seal, which is very high in vitamin E. The fact of the matter is, if people go into the Arctic wilderness unprepared, they will die. Having the right knowledge is a matter of life and death in a place like this. This is a community where one is not told how to do things. Instead, you learn by mistakes. Stories are a means of passing on knowledge, and more specifically, an indicator of what mistakes to avoid whilst out hunting. A mistake out on the sea ice in the midst of the winter could cost you a leg, as it did my friend Lasi in Savicevic, who fell asleep on a sledge and woke up with a leg that had turned to ice. Falling asleep on a sledge is about the most dangerous thing you can do. This is a society where it is difficult to get an answer to a direct question, where the directness of the white man is shunned. Conversations are invariably tangential. Storytelling, therefore, became, in part, a means to gain knowledge about the society, as I was simply not able to find out things by asking direct questions. This gentleman here is Inukitchok. Towards the end of my stay, I worked with him quite a lot. And through recording his stories of hunting trips, primarily in Canada and North Greenland, I documented with Inukitchok the place names in remote North Greenland and Ellesmere Island. These place names are being forgotten because it's no longer possible to hunt on Ellesmere Island. The sea is open all year round in parts. But if the ice comes back, the next generation of hunters will of course know nothing about these hunting grounds. And it's important to realise that Inuhui place names, or Inuit place names per se, often inform you of the land and sea use, and this is quite important. So if you take a place, Kamabek, that means the place where hunters lie in wait for sea animals, or Ugelehelik, a place where one finds Arctic hares. Now, many of the Canadian Inuit do not know these place names either, because they were not from their, or parts of the Canadian Arctic, they were not from there originally. They were forcibly relocated there to legitimise Canadian sovereignty over that part of the Arctic. As Keith Basso says in his 1984 book, place names are important in storytelling because they are situating devices as conventionalised instruments for locating narrated events in the physical settings where the events have occurred. So spoken stories were really the living encyclopedias of their ancestors, dynamic compendiums of practical knowledge and practical intelligence, I would add. Stories really carried the secrets of how to orient in the local cosmos. Hidden in the stories were precise instructions for the hunting of various animals, as well as specific insights regarding which plants were good to eat, which were poisonous, how to prepare certain herbs to heal cramps or sleeplessness or fever. The stories carried instructions about how to construct a winter shelter, what to do during a storm, and more generally, how to live well in the land without destroying the land's wild vitality. Before moving on to talk about drum dancing, here is the first couple of paragraphs of my own story, no less, that I told on local radio shortly before I left. It really just gives you an idea of what this language looks like according to my own orthography. I'm not the first linguist to work on this language. Various missionaries have compiled some word lists, and Michael Fortescue was there for a short period of time in the late 80s, and I started off using their word lists, but didn't get very far because people objected to them mainly. I've given a translation of this very short story. Some of you might be able to see it, but I'll just read it through for you now so you get an idea of the language.
Uanga ana rame kamahutni achakiga at the anakihunga. Apu angiho at the padatunga, behoto engahutunga. Ka doctor uangalo kanga musinam parihogu. Uanga kanga me hanilareke. Kanga ototresu kiole, kiene pikirisho, pikirisho, huli uto de maya pinyanuto. Nario tunga nano inoho at the habishivu haruto. Kine nano to hukko. Aona nano anguchivia. At the Narigama Beluto, behot of Hokicho. Nano, Buhime, Namehele, Malika, at the Nunakafima Beho. Kanga, Ichepto, Kanga, Kimet Kadu, at the Nano Hua Herkriga, among a metri utokia. Nano Hua, no Hua, Amakatre metre. In a hoi agedu, at the Nano Amiara. To the Minuti Uchango, Nakio, at the Tamame Kanga Pularika, at the Imetu de Temekabitu. In Abdunga, Kiene Erikahunga, Behotu, Nalhohoya, Amakanano Akta Chikito.
So it just gives you an idea of what this language looks like and what it sounds like. But now I want to go on to talk a little bit about the second spoken tradition, which is drum dancing. And the generic term for drum songs is Ingarujin. The only songs that are remembered today are drum songs related to a specific event and sung purely for entertainment. These are called bihek and were sung previously on festive occasions, often in connection with a mill. And as we saw at the beginning of the film, bihek are traditional pre-Christian songs, accompanied by a simple drum rhythm of three beats interspersed by a short rest. The first or third beat of the drum series tends to be accentuated, and the drum is typically held in the left hand. So let's just see Ayako perform. This is one of the songs, actually, that he sings about this business with the Arctic hares when he realised he wasn't going to be on the shaman. So as you see, there are drum song performances that comprise singing, they're drumming and dancing, and during the performance the singer will often close or partially close his eyes and enter a sort of trance-like condition. And the first description of the songs actually comes from Sir John Ross in his book Voyage of Discovery, published in 1819. Sir John Ross had come to the area in 1818 in search of the Northwest Passage, and the dances apparently reminded him of an epileptic movement. It would seem that drum dancing is actually a generally ancient tradition, because archaeologists working in the region have found the remains of drums made of whalebone that date back to the 12th century. Here we have Ayako again, Ayako Michik. So this is obviously in summer, in Kaanap, in July time. He's sitting here with his great-granddaughter, and he's holding the drum, or rather, the drum we call the pila. It's small, it's the smallest of all Inuit drums. It's oval-shaped, as you can see. It measures about 20 by 30 centimetres. The frame, or cap de rat, is made of caribou antlers, and the membrane is called the ihia. That is made from the peritoneum of a seal. The width of the frame is only about 2 to 3 centimetres, and it usually has 6 to 10 small holes around the edge to make the sound more shrill. As we saw in the film there, the drum is beaten on the lower side of the frame and never on the membrane. The drumstick is about 20 centimetres long, and at the far end of the drumstick it's tied to the end of the handle with a cord, which you can't quite see there, called a biduk da. Most of the songs in the Tula region are very simple. They last about a minute and a half long, and they can be really categorised into three different groups. First of all, there are those songs where all the words are meaningless or no longer understood. B, there are the songs where there are very few meaningful words. And C, there are songs with complete or nearly complete text. At the beginning of the drum song, the singer often remains almost motionless and often says a few introductory words about the song, about the origin of the song. And he often adds a few self-effacing remarks, such as, I've probably forgotten the song, you know, I'm not very good at this, I'm a rather poor singer, that kind of thing. As you saw there, the dancing consists of bending and twisting one's body, partly in time with the drum beats. The singer bends and stretches his knees, and the movements spread upwards through the body. The movement also comprises turning and twisting of the body as the weight is moved from foot to foot, although the position of the feet hardly actually changes. A song ends, as we saw there, when the drum dancer sings way, 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 like this, and raises his hands in the air in a sort of self-congratulatory pose. So let's just see if we can play another one of the songs here. This one has a slightly longer introduction where Ayako introduces it. He talks about the context in which the song came about whilst he was hunting in the fjord with some friends.
Imi nak kutak ku, awak
Drum dancing was used as a means of settling disputes. And I think it's significant that a drum hangs in most courtrooms in Greenland, but they were always primarily a form of entertainment. The spiritual culture behind the songs has now been almost completely forgotten. The missionaries who arrived in the area in 1910 considered drum songs to be pernicious pagan constructs, and the tradition was really very much suppressed. The missionary Gustav Olsen insisted that the singing of hymns should replace indigenous drum songs. Drum dancing also decreased significantly as an activity in the post-war period because people switched to singing hymns and listening to modern pop music. And after the establishment of the US Air Base in 1953 at Tula, it was possible to listen to Western music on the radio. So competition songs, or Ivar Rugin, are on the whole no longer remembered. But for the benefit of the curious field worker and for a bit of fun, an Ivernak, as it's called, was performed on more than one occasion whilst I was living in Siljopluk. In the olden days, conflicts, it seems, would have been settled in this manner. So at a competition song, the two participants perform in turn. One sings, drums and dances, while the other stands in front of the performer with a small, thin teasing stick, which you can see me holding here between my index fingers. This stick is called a aviohut, and during the song, the stick is rotated around on the vertical axis in front of the singer's face. Now, I should point out that I heard many conflicting accounts as to the purpose of drum dancing. Whilst living in Savicevic, for instance, I was frequently told that there was never a drum dancing tradition in that settlement, and yet I know Knud Rasmussen and Eric Holdfedt have recordings from there. Ayako Micic, whom we saw several times in various films, insisted that the songs were never used, in fact, for conflict resolution, and yet Eric Holdfedt managed to obtain recordings of competition songs in 1937. And in one of the songs, Bua Lossuak teases Asappa with a song about how his dogs are running backwards. In another, recorded as late as 1984 by Michael Hauser, a hunter from Savicevic mocks a hunter from Karnak for only hunting polar bear in Karnak, where it is easy to take shelter in nearby housing, unlike the real Arctic wilderness surrounding Savicevic. This kind of sort of macho teasing and ridiculing is still quite common today amongst hunters. Ayako Micic insisted that to me that his songs had never been recorded before, and yet I know he worked extensively with Michael Hauser at the beginning of the 1980s Michael Hauser is the world's expert on drum songs, I should point out. Shamanic language and the language of magic charms, incantations and formulas, it seems has all been forgotten. The loss of meaning of some of the words accompanying the drum songs is not recent either. It's not quite clear how the meaning of the words has been lost, but the language of these ancient songs would have been, I think, composed at a time when there was a traditional belief in the power of words, so it might be significant. One explanation for loss is that the epidemic of the early 19th century, caused by the arrival of Sir John Ross and his crew, killed, in fact, many of the elderly drum dancers, it would seem, who understood this shamanic language. And a significant proportion of the group was killed in this epidemic, and it might be that they were just left with the beats and the tunes. People could remember the words, perhaps, but few could be sure what they meant. Drum singing and storytelling has, I should point out, it's become professionalised, it's become commoditised. Therefore, it comes at a price. As an active, live, indigenous tradition, it is more or less dead. There are about 5 drum singers left who perform on special occasions. Whilst I was living in Karnak, Her Majesty the Queen of Denmark visited, and they performed in front of her, for instance. Storytelling and singing used to come together, I think, in the sense that the old stories used to include something called hefajin, which were songs that appeared in stories. But in my experience, these songs were only ever sung actually at the end of the story. So when I was recording Kuludengwak's life story, at the end of each chapter, he would always perform a drum dance. So I should probably work towards a conclusion now, which is going to be brief. And I think what I want to say really is that, and I've said this elsewhere many times before, but we are living in a rapidly changing, globalising world where I think some indigenous knowledge is being lost without record. And you can say, I think, that the Polar Eskimos are the canary in the cultural as well as the environmental coal mine. Globalisation and the culture of consumerism are certainly changing indigenous communities around the world, and not just in parts of Greenland. The disappearance of traditional spoken traditions, I think, might also have consequences for the relationship between Yinahui and the notion of place, which is something I've become interested in recently. And I wonder, in fact, if in this part of the Arctic, the primacy of place is being forgotten, superseded by a new abstract notion of space as a homogeneous and placeless void. The hunters are no longer nomadic. For the most part, they're rooted to a town. And as the stories disappear, the land and its particularizing stories begins to lose its multiplicitous power. The human senses are no longer as gripped and fascinated by the expressive shapes and sounds of particular places. So the place-based vernacular culture of face-to-face storytelling, I think, is now being replaced by the automated, violent video game where the only interaction is often with a lifeless console. The result, I think, is that some young people are losing the pulse of the place and are becoming impervious to the sensuous world, just as we have become in the West. The land is becoming less of an animate's expressive power. There's no doubt that the tradition of storytelling is inextricably linked to hunting. If there is no hunting because there's no Arctic sea ice, storytelling will inevitably disappear at some point completely. The young people are not people of the sea ice in the way that the older people are. This is what tells me that the tradition of storytelling in this extraordinary community risks disappearing altogether. If that is the case, I hope that I have managed to preserve some of the knowledge through the recording of the Yinahui stories and drum songs. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Stephen, for that wonderful talk and extraordinary footage as well that you were able to share with us. I'm sure there are many questions here, and there's also some drinks waiting for us outside, so I won't stand too long between you and that. But I'd like to start off with a slightly cynical question to you, and then perhaps a serious one. You mentioned early on, and it comes back in your conclusion, that the Yinahui do not believe, for the most part, in man-made climate change. Now, has that been picked up at all by the US Republican lobby and other deniers of these things? Because you think they love nothing more than a marginalised, you know, ethnic group in the hinterlands of Greenland as a vindication of their model. Mm. That's sort of one question. The other one I ask, a point that you return to again, this kind of commodification of these practices. One thing that we see around the world, and I think particularly of Asia now, is maybe epic oral traditions being turned into vernacular popular culture. The Ramayana on TV in India, massive epics that are aired on radio and in sort of UNESCO-funded gatherings. Is there any of that going on? Do these songs and traditions and narratives and stories make their way into education, into public media, radio, etc.?
Right. I'll start with the first question first. I should point out that most of the older people, I tended to work many of the older people, and the older people don't believe in man-made climate change. Some of the younger hunters do, so things might be changing. The second point, the answer to that question is certainly no, primarily because of the language. So just to be clear, this is a language spoken by 770 people. It's not the language of education, which is West Greenlandic. It's not the language of the church, which is West Greenlandic. It's not the language of administration, which is West Greenlandic or Danish. It's not the language of television, certainly not, which is primarily Danish. They do have their local radio, which was a boon for me, because I used to listen to the radio and learn a lot from that. And there is some storytelling on the radio, and I tried to organise that myself and bring people together. I tried to organise events getting young people interested in drum dancing. They were interested for about 5 minutes, and then they ran off and played their video games, as you might imagine. I don't think there's any real potential for that at all, primarily because the language acts as such a barrier. I mean, this dialect is difficult. Most Greenlanders don't understand it fully. It's different, of course, in West Greenlandic, where there is a tradition of storytelling on the radio, and everyone has a radio in Greenland. I don't really see, unfortunately, much potential for that.
Okay. I'm sure there are questions. Please.
There was a picture on the wall of one of the shots of Christ. What was the history of religion in the community?
So they were Christianized at the beginning of the 20th century, which is very late in Greenlandic terms. The rest of Greenland was Christianized much earlier, but because these people were living in such a remote place, it happened very late. But it also happened very quickly, it seems. Missionaries, Gustav Olsen in particular, came in 1910, and the community was probably converted very, very rapidly. Prior to that, there was a tradition of shamanism, as I mentioned, and that certainly would have existed for quite a long time afterwards, I think. It's interesting you mentioned that picture. I mean, you go into their homes, and you could be excused for thinking that you're in a very sort of religious community because you see all this Christian iconography. You tend to see lots of photographs of family members. You normally have a crucifix. You often have a couple of pictures of Christ, but in my experience, at least, they don't really engage very much with religion. They're much more symbols as opposed to anything else.
Can I ask about any Greenlandic wildlife service? Because in other parts of the Arctic, Inuit and Yupik blame conservation efforts for the decline in animals. So the Yupik blame the decline in geese numbers on the business of tagging, disrespectful to geese and in Iglurik, I was talking to a friend recently, and they blame the problems of polar bears on the business of tagging them, because again, it's disrespectful and it stops the hunting and so on and so forth. Is there a Greenlandic wildlife service that imposes these kind of disrespectful acts?
Yes, there is, and there's quite tension, as you might imagine, between the biologists, which are sent primarily from the government in Nuuk, 1,000 miles away, and they're sent up to this part of Greenland to essentially assess how many narwhal there are likely to be in the following season, how many polar bears, and so most of the things that they hunt have very strict quotas. And these quotas are determined by these biologists who have a lot of power, and the local hunters, for the most part, don't believe in it at all. I often heard them say that they didn't think that the numbers were decreasing. It was simply a question of they don't know where the animals are. Because of climate change, they're moving in different places, they're in different areas. And so up until the early, I think, 1990s, when the sea ice, they knew exactly when the sea ice was coming, knew exactly when it would leave, more or less. They also knew roughly where the animals are. But now that's all become very up in the air and unpredictable. And that has created many problems, and This community is quite dependent on narwhal hunting in the summer, but as far as I know, there were very few narwhals there this summer, and no one knows quite why. There was a killer whale in the bay, and that suddenly frightened quite a lot of them off. But so there's definitely tension between those groups, and particular biologists who are appointed by a government which is not very popular in that part of Greenland. Yeah.
I was wondering about the socialization of the children into speaking the language. I mean, is it gone, or do they start from the moment they go to school and learn Danish? Do they start, for example, mixing the dialect with Danish? Is there a process
That? That's a good question. So, so first of all, everybody in this community is bilingual. They speak West Greenlandic, and they speak Inuktitut or Polo Eskimo, which is the language of home. They're taught primarily in West Greenlandic, but sometimes in Danish because of lack of teachers. And the language of the younger people, so when I say the language, I mean Inuktitut or Polo Eskimo, the local language of the younger people is quite different from the language of the older people. And there's a significant influence, not from Danish, but from West Greenlandic, in terms of the lexicon, but more in terms of the sounds, the phonology of the language. And so often it felt almost as if the community had become sort of bi-dialectal, that there was, I mean, the gentleman Kuludengwak, the 88-year-old man, I mean, I found him extremely difficult to understand for much of the time. And he spoke a language which really was quite different from how the average teenager would speak in Karnak, I would say.
Could I just follow up on that very interesting question? Actually, Stephen, I mean, one thinks of any parts of the world where languages that themselves are endangered, minority, ethnic languages, are the languages that may be further predating on, if you'll excuse that term, very minority languages, such as, you know, Inuit. In other words, West Greenlandic, is it an endangered language? I mean, or not?
No, not at all.
Okay. But it is a language that sits in between the national language and the local language, right? And it's the language of mediation.
West Greenlandic has just become the sole official language of Greenland as of 2009. It has 55,000 speakers. It's a standardized language. It's, right. There's some literature behind it. Yeah. It's a language of television. It's a language of radio. Mm-hmm. No, it's not threatened at all. The two areas which are potentially threatened are here in northwest Greenland and in east Greenland,
okay,
where there's a similar situation but where there are three times as many speakers. And the point that I've often made is that, in a sense, this language is not endangered. It's only endangered in the sense that the community is. Providing they don't move away from there, the language will continue to be spoken. The problem is, you know, if in 25 years' time we're in a situation where there is no sea ice, and there's massive opportunities for mining and, you know, oil exploration, all the rest of it on the West Coast, many of the younger people might be tempted to leave. And if they do so, they will have to speak West Greenlandic. Mm-hmm. And then the language would soon disappear.
I see.
What system of local, I would say government, that might be too elaborate a phrase, but how would the community look after itself systematically?
So the organisation of Greenland has changed very considerably over the last couple of years. It used to be broken up into 18 different regions. That's now been split into four or five, I think. So now the people in this very remote place in northwest Greenland are essentially governed by somebody in Ilulissat, which is an awful long way away and a very different world, really. And people were not very happy about that. And whilst I was there, there were some representatives of the government that came, and you know, I certainly noticed the tension, and there were some notices up in the shop, which were, you know, they feel as if they're being forgotten, they feel as if they're being neglected, and they feel as if their own government sort of looks down upon them, really, because they're hunters and they're not part of the new Greenlandic economy, which presumably is going to be based on oil and everything else.
So are there such things as local spokesmen, representatives?
Yes, there is, yeah. So there's something called the Comuna, which is the local authority.
Yes.
And there's a local figure there, and he will report to somebody in Ilulissat.
Yeah.
But the impression that I get is that ultimately the power is in Ilulissat. They really pull the strings.
So who appoints that police?
So that policeman, he came from Nuuk. I'm not sure who appointed him. I imagine somebody in the Ilulissat.
Yes.
Although that's interesting, actually, because so as of 2009, Greenland now has self-rule, which means it has more and more autonomy, and for the first time they're now in charge of their own policing.
Yeah.
Whereas before, that was the responsibility of the Danes, so that's changed quite a lot over the last 2 years.
Further question here.
You spoke about the outcast in the wilderness. Mm. Is there a ritual for casting someone out?
No, there's not a ritual. So you're referring to this phenomenon of a kevitdok. I'm not sure it really still happens in Greenland. I certainly heard stories about it, but I didn't witness it. But these are people that, you know, don't, for whatever reason, don't feel as if they can be part of the community or society any longer. And they can't sort of face the music and they leave and go out to the wilderness and ultimately that's their demise. But I'm not aware. I mean, this is more of a historical phenomenon. I'm certainly not aware of any rituals that are associated with that. But I might be wrong.
And in the stories, so it's people who voluntarily leave.
Yes. Well. Yes. Yeah. I think it is voluntary. Yeah. Mm. I mean, there might be some pressure on them to do so, but ultimately, that's their decision. They're not. I don't think that they were forced out of the community.
There's a question in the back.
Chris, you mentioned the context that the visit by a local government and the nurses in the shop. And I'm interested in the degree to which both the language and the perpetuation of the lifestyle is stigmatized on one hand, or you talked about the codification of drug testing, for instance, or the degree to which it might be reified or commodified and are celebrated. Is that, and how that plays itself out on the local level, or is this
Yeah, so drum dancing is not unique to this region of Greenland. It's performed in various parts of Greenland. To give you one example, whilst I was there, there was something called a Greenland Culture Day, and various parts of Greenland celebrated their culture in different ways. And actually in East Greenland, they did a lot of drum dancing, whereas in my community, they celebrated it more with telling of stories. Yes, it's, as I say, it's very much become commoditized. It doesn't really work as a live indigenous tradition anymore, as far as I can see. But then it's also difficult being an outsider and being someone who's explicitly there to document this. So you're setting yourself up as a bit of a target in terms of how these traditions are perceived. I'm not sure that answers your question.
Is the way to put it is the local culture stigmatized or something?
Uh-huh. Stigmatized within sort of Greenland, you mean? No, I think what is stigmatized is more the hunting culture. I don't think anyone's looking down on them and saying, drum dancing, that's not for us. It's more the people in government, the people in power who are perceived by the Inukhui to be quite unrepresentative of Greenlanders. I think it's they feel as if they are looking down on them because they are hunters and that's something, primitive. I think that's the main focus of any stigmatization, as opposed to the culture, the cultural traditions.
Can I ask a related question? Is there a specific way that young people talk about their reluctance to hunt? Because that's a way of stigmatizing.
No, I don't think so. I think it's simply a question, really, of they're reluctant to hunt because the life is just they just see the life as too difficult. It's difficult to feed a whole family if you're a hunter. The only way you can really get it to work is if you have is if your wife has a job in the school or the church or the commune or something like that. So I don't think there's a way of talking about it which stigmatizes it. I think it's just a recognition of the fact that there are easier options.
Mm-hmm. There's a question here.
But what you've showed us and what you've talked about is mostly male things, hunting, storytelling, drumming. And I was wondering if you had an opportunity to also listen to women talk about themselves, or also intimate talk between a man and a woman, and children.
Right. Yeah, I should point out that there's some sort of hope for the community in a way. There's a woman in her late 20s called Navahana Dunak, and she is a great singer, and she's got involved in this drum dancing, and she's composed some of her own songs, and I recorded her. She's a very shy lady. She didn't want to be videoed, but I have recordings of that. So she and one other woman are quite involved, I would say, in terms of those cultural traditions. In terms of storytelling, yes, it's true that I showed mainly men here, but I worked with quite a few elderly women who are very good storytellers. The subject material was quite different, as you might imagine, but no less interesting.
Do you know who performed the drum dances in the past? Was it all members of society? Just shamans, men and women?
No, I don't think it was just shamans. I think it was more than that. It was a fairly sort of wide form of entertainment. I think it would have been mainly men in the past. I think women is perhaps more of a recent thing. And I suspect it would be, you know, sort of not an elder, but, you know, an older member of the community who is sort of looked up to and is someone who traditionally has passed on knowledge and that kind of thing. And of course that's how it is more or less today as well. The few drum dancers left are people who are, you know, highly respected and elderly people for the most part.
I noticed the word meters in the text that you read. Do they import European words when they need them into their language?
Yes, there are quite a few. I mean, not directly into their language, but there are quite a few loan words in West Greenlandic, which ultimately end up in their local language, though they might sound quite different, because sometimes they're adapted to the phonology of their local language. But on the whole, I would say not that many, actually, compared to, you know, various sort of European languages that absorb so many words from English. I would say on the whole, no.
Are there indigenous words for email and Facebook and video games? Or not? No,
they
borrow from Danish?
They've not gone the route of the Icelanders, where they sort of have committees making up words and that kind of thing. Yeah. they've not gone that route.
I have one other question about outcasts. I'm going back to it. You told us last night about the man who tried to kill you.
I didn't say he tried to kill me.
I might need it there. who'd been ejected from another community. So there is a form of, in a sense, local justice. Who enforces that?
Yeah, I mean, historically there's been a system of exile.
Yes.
Because there's not been an established prison system in Greenland. That's beginning to change now. Yeah. They're building a prison in Nuuk. But previously, you know, if you committed a crime, then your punishment was to be sent to another place. As for who administers that, not sure. I know the answer to that question, but not local people. I mean, it would be in the capital, in Nuuk.
Right, yeah.
That's not something that's local, not as far as I know. No. Yeah, no.
Yeah. I was just wondering. On one hand, these songs are sort of being presented as age-old phenomena and this idea that they're linked to place, but obviously you have a reasonably recent migration in the sense that they came over in the 19th century.
Mm.
I was just wondering, a lot of the songs and stories we've seen for a while are sort of intimately linked to individuals, so whether this tradition, are there set formulas for people to put the songs forward whereby, you know, songs don't have to be static and the meanings attached to places and songs can change but they're sort of improvised or told in certain ways. How does it work? Because, you know, it's obviously not a static tradition. So
no, well, the songs is very difficult because, to be honest, I've got about 25 hours of recordings, not just songs but of stories as well, and many of the songs don't have words or some of them have some words. And many of them have words which are no longer understood. So it's quite difficult to answer your question in that respect, I think. but I don't. I mean, it's static in the sense that they're all about 1 minute long, between 1 minute and 1 minute and a half. They all have this sort of three beat rhythm. So that I've never seen an alternate, you know, a variation of that. So it's pretty much set in stone, I would say. New songs are not, apart from the odd song that Navarana has composed, on the whole, they're, I'm not aware of any new songs that have been composed within this tradition. So.
A last question.
Yeah, about memory.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned the gentleman who described his third birthday in great detail.
Yeah.
So is but would that be real memory as we would see it, or is it memory in a different way, just as dreams maybe are perceived as more real?
Yeah, memory? That's a good question. No, it's definitely memory as we see it. Because he told this story about how he went to he'd got some money for his birthday, and he'd gone to the shop. There must have been a tiny little store there in the 1930s, and he spent it all on sweets, and he bought so many sweets that he couldn't hold all these sweets, and he talks about how he staggered back to the settlement, and then he becomes very embarrassed because he realises he's not strong enough, he's not big enough to hold all these sweets, so he starts hiding these little caches of sweets around and goes back to them, and he went into great detail. I mean, this went on for a long time, so I'm quite sure that is real memory. And not dreams, yeah.
Yes, I was reminded that it said that Caligula used to say that his memory was so good that he remembered the admiring look on the faces of the midwives.
Well, that hopeful note. No senior moments withstood. Thank you, Stephen, once again, yes, for this wonderful and astonishing. Let's all remember to go and have a drink and chat informally now as well. Thank you all.